Hello, thank you for downloading us. This is take three, introduced with our traditional style.
Questions, questions.
First one coming from Emily Lind in Brooklyn, in New York. Dear Slarty Bartfast and Wow Bagger, the infinitely prolonged.
Excellent.
I don't actually remember Wow Bagger.
Wow Bagger the Infinitely Prolonged is the one who he can't die, and so therefore he decides that he will go around the world, around the universe, insulting everybody in alphabetical order. Is that not Wow Bagger the Infinitely Prolonged? Because he can't, and he has to do something with his time, and so he insults every creature in the universe in alphabetical order.
That sounds appropriately Douglas Adams-y.
I believe that's correct.
Anyway, Emily says, your recent interview with Daniel Kaluuya reminded me that whenever I see him in anything, I find myself thinking, wow, I love his face.
Yes.
There is just something about the way he is able to emote through even the smallest facial movements that always blows me away. The best example I can think of is the lengthy scene in Nope, where he is sitting in his truck doing nothing and yet conveying everything. So absolutely. Who is the actor whose face you can't get enough of? Not the most handsome or most beautiful, but the one who you can't take your eyes off because they are capable of telling you 1,000 things with one clenched jaw.
Well, I think Daniel Kaluuya is a brilliant example. And I think that scene when he's in the truck and not saying anything, I think right down to the fact that the title of that film is Nope. And, you know, one of the most important scenes when he just says, nope. But I was thinking, I think the screen face that I am most impressed by is Kate Dickey, who I just think every time you see Kate Dickey, you think you're looking at a different actor. You know, so Red Road was the thing that made her name, the Andrea Arnold film. Since then, she's been in For Those in Peril with Gorgeous George Mackay, The Witch, which is an extraordinary film. She's in Green Knight. She's got a role in Ridley Scott's Prometheus. She's in Couple in a Hole, which we showed in Shetland. All of those films, you could think you were watching a different person. And she is absolutely, for me, the definition of an actor whose face, you know, speaks 1,000 words. You know, she really does do that thing about she doesn't need to. And in fact, in Couple in a Hole, there's very, very little dialogue. It's all to do with the kind of micro expressions on her face. And I think she does it fantastically. The other person I'd say actually is Cillian Murphy in Oppenheimer, because what Nolan has done in that film is to shoot facial close-ups in IMAX. I think Cillian Murphy's face in Oppenheimer is like a kind of landscape of tiny, tiny emotions. But I would say across the board, Kate Dickey for consistently being the most expressive actor in terms of their facial expressions.
So I was sitting in Copenhagen Airport yesterday.
How was that, incidentally?
Was it
wonderful, wonderful?
It was crowded, that's for certain.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, about these questions. And the first person that came to mind was Tom Hardy, for the way he managed to act with a full face mask on in Chris Nolan's film about Dunkirk. But anyway, I then started thinking, if only I could ask an actor. So I did message our good friend, Jason, and I asked and I said to him, who's the best face actor in your experience? If that makes sense, okay.
Please tell me you did say other than you, obviously.
And I said maybe a good face actor is just a good actor, and then he replied by saying, and this is a redacted version of what he said, okay?
Okay.
The question literally makes no sense whatsoever. I remember my brother asking me with typically veiled criticism why I'd pulled a particular face at a particular point in the film, as if that had been my intention, instead of feeling or wanting or experiencing whatever the character was. No actor, certainly not any that I'd respect, is or should be conscious of doing anything with their face unless there's Bell's palsy involved. Or, and then he gives some examples, which I won't mention. And then he says, some people, though, just have a manner or a mode of expression or animation that's more engaging to encounter or tells the story of their inner world more clearly. They're not doing it on purpose, I'd suggest, but living the experience of the moment. So it's a balance. The camera can see your secrets to an extent, but very few of us are genuinely blank at key moments in our lives. He then tells a very entertaining story of dashing to the gym and grabbing a water bottle from his house and then arriving at the gym and realizing that what he's got is one of our water bottles with "Hello to Jason Isaacs" written on it. And he said, if you can imagine being the actual Jason Isaacs with a water bottle with your name on it, that's super embarrassing.
That's anyway. Good. Can I just add to Kate Dickey, Jodie Foster? And I know I understand exactly what Jason means about anyone who, because I don't think that Kate Dickey sits there thinking, what am I doing with my face? I think that what happens is that she's a brilliant actor and she happens to have one of those faces that can telegraph emotions. And I think Jodie Foster is the same, because I've just started watching Jodie Foster in, what's it, you know, True Detective Night, the new thing. And I've got no idea what's going on in the series, but I've got quite a good idea what's going on in her head.
It's interesting. I just found it interesting that Jason just said, you know, that it, maybe this is kind of, I guess what I'm saying is this is kind of a conversation that non-actors have. And,
yeah,
and if
exactly.
you're an actor, you think differently. Anyway, thank you for the question, James T. Two quick questions. Mark, when was the last time, yes. This is a very, very straightforward question, I think. When was the last time you watched The Exorcist?
November.
Two, have either of you ever thought about writing or making a film, e.g. Roger Ebert writing Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
Okay, you want to go first on this second part, because I've got a very short answer.
I've thought about a book becoming a movie, and then when the movie rights were sold or TV rights were sold, thought about writing a screenplay to go with the film or to go with the TV adaptation, and then realized that in general, experts do it better. And that although I am very strongly tempted to have a go, employing someone who is much better than I am is a better line of inquiry. So,
and also, in the words of Jeremy Harding, you're not a scab.
So yeah, that's right. So employ an expert. So there's an adaptation which is being worked on at the moment. And whenever I work with the person who's doing the, or talk to or email the person who's doing the adaptation, thinking that they're just much better at this than I am, because guess what? They've done it before and they actually know what they're doing. So yes, I am tempted, but I expect always to leave it to the experts. Mark, you're very short.
There's a very funny.
Sorry.
There's a very funny line in the new Mean Girls. You know, the film of the musical of the film, in which the main character says to the teacher, "I was homeschooled," and the teacher says, "Oh, homeschooled! What a lovely way of taking jobs away from my union."
Yeah.
My answer to that question is no. There's a proviso, which is, I mean, obviously, I've made a lot of documentaries in which I've written and presented them, and I helped Friedkin do a polish on his narration for The Devil and Father Amort. But no, I would never make a film, write a film, direct a film, because you wouldn't want to see it. You absolutely would not want to see it. One of the reasons I love watching movies is because I couldn't make one. I think that the worst film critics are frustrated filmmakers.
Having said all that, I am still quite tempted, but I probably will always.
But you're not a film critic. You're a film journalist. You know, as you've always said, you're the presenter, I'm the critic. So from your point of view, you are a creative. And actually, if you went off and did it, that would be fine. But from my point of view, as somebody who has spent his whole life watching, you know, I am like Chauncey Gardner in Being There. I like to watch. That's it. You would not want to see a film that I made. Nobody would want to see a film
that I made. Bob Fenton has a question. I know it's a bit delayed, yes. But when I was listening to your marvellous Napoleon interview, a comment from Joaquin Phoenix really stood out. He stated that he did not know which scene Ridley had used in the movie, implying that he hadn't watched it. I know many actors don't watch films that they've made, but it struck me as very odd for an artist to have no interest in their output. Like musicians denying themselves listening to the final mix of a song, or a painter throwing a blanket over a freshly splodged masterpiece. The conclusion seems to be that the act of acting is the reward, and once that process is complete, there is no pleasure to be derived from the result. Or are they just embarrassed at seeing themselves on screen? Or don't they trust the director or editor to do them justice? Or they think the film is a stinker? Do you know any actors you could ask. Actually, I could have asked Jason that as well, but I thought I'd used up enough of his time. But we do occasionally come across actors who just will not watch their stuff. I don't know.
It is more common than you think. And I have met quite a few actors who actively avoid watching anything they've done because they think it won't help them. I don't think it's just fragile ego. I think it's simply that they think, and I imagine in the case of Joaquin Phoenix, that this is absolutely the case, that he thinks all the work is done on set. It's not that he doesn't care, but all the work is done on set. You know, one thing that people say is, now that you have what used to be called video assist, the fact that you shoot a scene and then you can immediately watch it back on high def screens, some actors really like that because it means they can see their performance immediately and then they can tweak it. Other actors hate it. They absolutely hate it. They do not want to see what they just did. They want to, for the moment, again, I mean, this
that is a type of vanity, though, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is vanity. I think it is genuinely that they find that it doesn't help.
Well, seeing what we're seeing, I mean, it doesn't help. That seems strange.
Well, no, bear in mind, I'm not an actor, so if you're on stage and you're doing a performance, you're not seeing what the audience is seeing. You're feeling the role, I presume this is the case, and you are feeling that that you're doing it right. But I know enough actors who I don't think are vain. I mean, I'm sure some actors are, but, you know, I know enough actors who aren't vain who simply do not want to watch their stuff back. And actually, one of the reasons why we've always said on the show it's great to interview directors because they, you know, they've got stuff invested in them. It's quite often because they're the ones who've seen the film. I mean, if you ever interview an actor about a film, you quite often have to ask, have you seen the finished film? I mean, obviously, if you're making schlock, you know, then and you don't care, that's fine. I mean, I know at least one film critic who would never read their copy in print because they knew that what the publication did to it was so horrific that they just never wanted to be confronted with it. So they would write their copy and submit it and then just think they can do what they want. I can't bear it. But I think in the case of actors, it is that for some actors, whatever their technique is, it is not helped by watching watching it back.
It is an interesting comparison, though, because you will not find a musician who doesn't want to listen back to their album to hear what we're hearing.
Yes, no, I think that is true, but I think there is just something. I mean, like I said, we're not actors, and in a way, what we really need is Jason here talking about this. But it's happened over the years. I've met enough people who just don't do it and absolutely hate doing it and will avoid doing it unless they have to think, okay, well, it's not just vanity.
Philip Raby says, my son teaches at a school in London and has asked me for ideas for films illustrating positive and toxic masculinity. The main catch being that they have to be for 12-year-olds, and most toxic masculinity has an 18 or at least a 15 certificate. For positive masculinity, I'm suggesting Tom Hanks in A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood and James Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. But I'm keen to hear more ideas. As for the toxic end of the spectrum, all I can think of is Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight or possibly Robert Mitchum in The Night of the Hunter. But they're somewhat caricatured. They're somewhat caricatured characters. Please offer your thoughts. Obviously, we've talked long and hard about Tom Hanks in A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood, and he came on the programme. The thing is that Mr. Rogers is not... It's difficult to say be like that because he was a very, very specific, gentle, caring person.
Yes.
But it's an interesting issue because a lot of... So I ended up going down the line. So for toxic first, because that's sort of slightly more... I was thinking whenever bullies are portrayed in movies, I ended up going actually to Back to the Future as something that would be enormous fun to watch. But looking at what happens to Biff Tannen... Then explaining that that's Donald Trump back in the day, yeah, and now look where we are, is at least an interesting discussion to have with 12-year-olds. Yes. What about toxic, first of all? What do you think?
Well, okay, so I thought about this. The bully thing I thought of absolutely. In terms of toxic masculinity, here's what I came up with, because what you were talking about was that the film has to be suitable for 12-year-olds. And in fact, I think that when this film came out, it was a double A certificate film, meaning that you had to be 14. I'm not sure what the current certification is, but I saw it when I was 12 at school, and that's the Peter Brooks version of Lord of the Flies. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I don't know whether this is still the case, but it used to be that every school kid, it was like it was one of the books that was on the syllabus. And obviously what Lord of the Flies is about, I mean, as the title suggests, because it's a biblical allusion, you know, it's Beelzebub, it's about original sin and all that stuff. But it's also, it's kind of like, you know, a reworking of, you know, Highway to Jamaica, all that sort of stuff. It is a story about a group of boys put on an island who then, in an accelerated way, fall apart and fall into vicious tribalism, and they bully, and indeed, I think this isn't a plot spoiler because I think everybody knows this, and indeed kill the kid that they refer to as Piggy. And I've always found that, I mean, I remember watching that film. I had to get a letter from my parents to say, you know, we were okay to see it because it was a Film Society thing, but it was a double A certificate. But Lord of the Flies is an extraordinary novel. And that film of it, that Peter Brooks film of it, I think is amongst other things, a portrait of young toxic masculinity, that they are kids and they're put on an island and they turn into
So positive then, again, this is not hugely original. I think I'm speaking for both of us. We think the best Harry Potter film is Prisoner of Azkaban. And yes. David Thewlis playing Remus Lupin is a fantastic teacher who is struggling and blah, 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 you know, and but cares for his kids that are in his charge. And I thought, even Black Panther, to be honest, you know, T'Challa.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there are lots of positive role models in films which are designed for people who are 12. What about you?
Yeah, well, I think those are really good examples. And not least, I mean, Black Panther is a very good example because it is a spectacular adventure film that any 12-year-old would watch and enjoy. And those things are absolutely written into the DNA of it. Me being me, I sort of end up thinking, well, you know, Amazing Mr. Blunden, because it's about somebody who has done a terrible thing and is now, you know, willing to make the ultimate sacrifice to redeem themselves and, you know, to not be the bad person that they were. And I love The Amazing Mr. Blunden, and it's a great, it's a great kids film. But I do, actually, Black Panther, I think, is a great example.
Andrew Galvin, Dear Aladdin Sane and the Thin White Duke, what is the worst lyric in the best song? So this is quite an interesting one because there are lots of rubbish songs with rubbish lyrics. This has to be a really good song with terrible lyrics. Anyway, Andrew says, I'm listening to David Bowie's Black Star album a lot at the moment due to what a family member is currently going through. And I'd have to plump for Lazarus. I love this song, but Bowie randomly singing, I was looking for your ass, is just bizarre. This is... So come up with a good song with terrible lyrics.
Okay, well, I've got what I think is absolutely the creme de la menthe, the Arc de Triomphe, the whatever it is. I love ABBA, as you know. Who doesn't? And I think Winner Takes It All is one of those just immortally brilliant records. And, you know, I Don't Want to Talk, and we've talked about, you know, Meryl Streep doing it as a Shakespearean thing, and everything about The Winner Takes It All, and, you know, you've come to shake my hand, and all that stuff is heartbreaking, but it does include the line, a big thing or a small, and I'm sorry,
not good.
No.
I slightly dispute the fact that a great song needs great lyrics at all, really, because... it can be enigmatic, or you might be thinking, what on earth are you going on about? It doesn't matter. It can be a terrific song just because the overall sound of it is amazing. The ones that instantly sprung to mind, The Associates' Party Fears 2, which is a great song, but does begin, I have a shower and call my brother up, which is Really? Okay, not quite sure. How?
And then within the hour, I'll smash another cup.
But the overall song is fantastic. I do like, because child one, recently married, was born.
Congratulations.
I suppose I take some responsibility. Was born when "Everything I Do It For You" by Bryan Adams was number one. So I have a copy of that. I have like a gold disc or a platinum disc or something, which the record company gave me. But it does contain this line, which if anyone at school put this into a piece of creative writing, it would be covered in red circles. See me.
Go on.
There's no love like your love, and no other could give more love. In other words, I'm rhyming love with love because I can't think of anything else that will fit. I mean, there's obviously things like "Sure as Kilimanjaro rises like an Olympus above the Serengeti," which it doesn't, in Toto's Africa. But, but really, I mean, really, Bryan Adams, it's like his most successful song, but it rhymes love with love, which I don't think is allowed, is it?
No, actually, that is absolutely cheating.
Andrew Gowan, who sent that question in, says, by the way, the correct answer for which films should be Muppeted, which is what we were talking about last week. Is Die Hard, with all the actors replaced except for Alan Rickman.
Perfect. That would be good. Absolutely perfect. Absolutely perfect. And if only Alan Rickman was still here to do that, that would have been a wonderful thing.
In fact, on that subject, I was going to come to this later, but Connor in Cork says, what was the gone too soon loss that deprived our society the most? So, because you mentioned Alan Rickman, and that thought had occurred to me, what a loss he was. So what was the gone too soon loss that deprived our society the most?
I mean, do we mean in general or in artistic sphere?
I mean, I have to, yes, I mean, go on.
Well, no, I was, you know, the first thing that leapt to mind, although I know this is kind of, it's the default answer, but, you know, I read so many articles about John Smith, you know, if only John Smith would have been the great prime minister that we never had. I think David Bowie, despite the fact that he lived a long and full life, still had so much more. So I think that's, you know,
I was going for the,
that's up.
Amy Winehouse was the first one that occurred to me, only because she really was young. And, you know, she almost certainly would have come up with more classic albums. Kirsty MacColl occurred to me. Heath Ledger, partly because there's a Batman question, which, in fact, Heath Ledger was mentioned in one of the questions earlier. But when you see his, you know, his last few performances, you're thinking, wow, he was astonishing.
Yeah, and you know, and Richie Valens, who was Richie Valens was what, 17, I think. You know, and then, but then, in a way, that sort of leads you down the, you know, the James Dean, and I mean, I would say Nora Ephron.
Yes,
I mean, Nora Ephron again. You know, led a full and wonderful life, but I, again, still had so much more to offer. It's one of those questions that you can't really answer, because it's like, when people are doing brilliant work, they can live to 99 and do brilliant work, and you still think that they left too soon. I mean, the Amy Winehouse, I think, is that is probably the correct and, you know, and on the money answer. I mean, Buddy Holly,
yes,
you know,
absolutely. Julie,
I mean, actually, there is a very good argument for Buddy Holly, because at the point that Buddy Holly died, his entire approach to music was changing, and what Buddy Holly would have done after that is one of those great, you know, people talk about Elvis, but, you know, what Buddy Holly was on the cusp of something at the point that he died. And that is, you know, I think that is a great loss.
Julie Gehr in Richmond, if you were paid £1,000 per hour to play a game, what would it be?
Minecraft. I would play Minecraft forever.
Yeah, so I guess this could, I mean, I was thinking of video game, but it could be, you know, it could be Monopoly or Cluedo or GoldenEye was a fantastic video game. The last video game that I played,
I heard that
I actually beat my son at. And then after the first play, got slaughtered every time. I kind of lost interest. But hey, if you're going to pay £1,000, I'll play anything. I'll play netball for £1,000 an hour.
Have you ever played Minecraft?
No, I don't think I have.
You can lose entire days because it's just world building. That's all it is. It's not crashy, smashy, shooty, chasey, jumpy. It's just buildy, buildy, buildy. Diggy, 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 buildy, buildy. And it's just wonderful.
That's a very interesting description of the game. Martha in North Carolina, what's a line you'd never cross? I'm going to defer to you on this because I suspect you've got quite a few.
Well, I mean, you know, right now, at the point that we're recording this, Ron DeSantis has just stood down and endorsed Trump. And I would say the line I would never cross is worshipping the devil in the name of God. I think, you know, I genuinely think that religious types, Christians, backing Trump is just like, it is worshipping the devil in the name of God. And I think that is not.
I did get a phone call asking me if I wanted to go on GB News to appear with on the Nigel Farage show.
How many lines have we crossed in that sentence?
Anyway, I just thought it's easy to come up with lines that I would never be asked to cross. You know, like I think it's morally inexcusable for politicians to appear on news organizations which are paid for by Iran or Russia, and there are many in this country who do precisely that, but I would never get asked to do that. So that's hardly a line that I would cross. But I have been asked to be on GB News, and I definitely said no.
I too was asked to be on GB News, and I too explained to them what they could do with themselves and the horse upon which they rode in.
Adam in Teddington, I'll keep it brief. Thank you, Adam. Marmite, ? To which the answer is most definitely 100% yes, at all times and in all places.
And I would add, with peanut butter.
Oh, the greatest gift that God has given.
Yes.
Hot toast, peanut butter and Marmite. Could eat that for the rest of my life, although my salt intake would increase slightly inconveniently for my cardiologist's point of view. Okay, so that's two big yeses. What phrase needs to die immediately?
Make America great again.
Yeah. Okay. How about, well, okay, so let's circle back from that. That phrase needs to die immediately, as does the mainstream media. Anyone who says MSM or mainstream media is basically using it as a shorthand for I'm not smart cretin. Enough. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Going forward.
Oh, yeah.
I know, right?
I'm not being funny. But
just saying.
Or
apostrophe.
So.
Yeah. And I suspect a lot of these are losing battles because once they're there, they're there. Reaching out for rather than.
Oh, I hate that. I hate people reaching out. Reaching out is like, no, just absolutely no, don't. You didn't reach out. You sent them an email. We reached out to their people. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. You rang them up.
It seems very strange because that, why, where did that come from? How does that help? It makes it sound so emotional. You know, you reach out in moments of, reach out, I'll be there.
I'll be there, yeah, exactly.
But that's not saying, reach out, I'll be there if you want me to go to the shops for you. It's saying, reach out if you're in a state of emotional crises, and then I'll be there for you. I'll be your bridge over troubled water. Moving on, different songs. But when the Four Tops were reaching out, they weren't suggesting that they could do, like, small menial tasks for people.
Reach out for an interview. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Would that be right?
Yeah, I think we could. I think that's probably top of the list, losing, okay. Reaching out.
Finally, Rob in Brisbane. Love the show, Steve. My schmestion is, how do you order or categorise a record collection? I have an increasingly expanding eclectic vinyl collection that has everything from 1958 10-inch Best of Peter Sellers to Arctic Monkeys and pretty much everything in between. Do you just go alphabetically or by genre or decade? Alphabetically in those subcategories? Currently, it's a messy jumble, and I'd appreciate the advice. Well, Rob, you're going to get two very different answers, So I suspect we should defer to Mark first.
My favourite ever record categorisation system is by the narrator of High Fidelity, the novel High Fidelity, who regularly reorders all his records. But he comes up with a system which is the best system in the world,
yes,
which is that he orders his records in the order that he bought them. So he has a record system that nobody can understand other than him. So literally, he reorders his entire record collection in the order that he bought the records. And there is something so perfect about that, I wish I could do it. But I just, honestly, in the end, I just, within very broad categories, they're alphabetized. So it's just yeah, they're just alphabetized, because I don't have the willpower to, but I do think ordering your record collection in the order that you bought the records is perfect. What about you?
Messy jumble. It's just messy jumble shoved anywhere is the actual answer. I wish it wasn't, but that's what it is. I mean, I do think that in general, messy jumble is fine, and then maybe I should aim to arrange alphabetically, which I still prefer to alphabetized, by the way,
sorry,
which feels
fine.
Clunky. The 10% of records that I actually listen to, because however big your record, it's like your clothes. You probably wear about 10% of your clothes. You probably listen to 10% of the records that you've got. So I could probably look at the 20 or 30 records that get played a lot and arrange those a bit, but then there's a small number, so I could just spot them anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm just going to stick with a messy jumble.
Yes. I mean, so either alphabetized or a messy jumble. That's pretty much it.
Your questions, please, for next week. They can be profound, they can be cinematic, they can be about Marmite, although I think we probably finished with Marmite, don't you? I don't think there are any other questions about Marmite.
No, Marmite, it's a resounding yes.
Okay, so that's all sorted. But your questions for next week, we would welcome them, please. Send them to correspondence@curbertomeo.com. Thank you for listening. Take one and take two with you on Friday.